Hello, you're listening to Fresh Wellness with Lisa Shebeck, and welcome to my podcast. A homeopath by trade, with the aim of helping you discover health, natural living, and alternative therapies to bring you down the rabbit hole. In this episode of Fresh Wellness with Lisa Shebeck, I'm delighted to speak to Dr. Lisa Summitt about her new book, Emotional Repatterning, Healing Emotional Pain by Rewiring the Brain. Dr. Summitt is a well-known health practitioner who uses homeopathy and naturopathic healing in her international practice based in Montreal. She specialises in homeopathy, emotional wellness, nutrition and lifestyle optimisation. When emotional issues are an obstacle to healing, Dr. Summitt uses the emotional repatterning techniques presented in her book to help patients uncover and rebalance the deep subconscious beliefs that often underlie their unhappiness, stuckness, and mental or physical pain. The results have been nothing short of life-changing. She's written this book to broaden access to the tools that she uses in her practice to help people change their perspectives, subconscious beliefs, and ultimately to suffer less. No, thank you so much for coming on. So I want to know, that if you, in your own words, you know, why you came to write the book, if you can share with my listeners.
Yes. So let's see. How did I come to write the book? That's a great question. It's something that kind of wrote itself. You know, it was almost like an urge. I never planned to write a book. I never, you know, had any dreams of being an author. But I think what happened was, you know, I'm also a homeopath. I'm primarily a naturopathic doctor and a homeopath. And, you know, throughout the years, people said to me, oh, you should write a book on homeopathy. And I thought, you know, I don't really feel like I have anything new to say about homeopathy. There's plenty of great books out there. You know, if you sprain your ankle, use Arnica and, you know, these kinds of things. It's like, I felt like I don't want to write a book just to repeat what's already been said. So I dismissed that idea. I think after working with people more deeply on the emotional realm in the last few years, which is, you know, I'm still very much a homeopath, but I've, you know, shifted a lot of my practice to working with people emotionally, and we'll get into why. But I felt that after 4, 5, 6 years of doing so, there were just such obvious, you know, kind of conclusions that came out of that. And I ended up thinking, well, why doesn't anybody speak about these things? You know, why were we never told about how to navigate our emotional world better? Like, why aren't these ideas out there somewhere? And then suddenly I felt that I actually had something to say that hadn't really been said before, at least not that I ever came across. Yeah. So once I felt like, oh, I need to say this because people don't know this. I didn't know these things, you know, with all the education that I had and with all, you know, I was raised by, I think, pretty smart people. And, you know, I mean, nobody ever discussed any of this. And I suddenly felt like I need to write about this, you know. And then, you know, I think that maybe that's how many good books are born. Like the author feels they have an urge to communicate something that's not very obvious or not really out there. And I think that was the origins of writing it.
Well, it's a great read and really easy to read as well. I sort of devoured it in less than a day.
That's great.
No, I loved it. Can you tell the listeners in sort of your own words in a nutshell what it's about?
Yeah, so it's essentially about how to explore our subconscious mind to understand what negative beliefs, negative patterns of thought, thinking traps, which I'll go into in a moment, etc., kind of exist there. And it directs the reader to, you know, take a step into that world, understand what's there, and then it gives a very straightforward and easy tool to start to change some of the beliefs that we have, mostly about ourselves, but also about the world and who we are in the world. And it's actually very easy because, you know, we think, oh, well, you know, how do we change things in our subconscious mind? Sounds complicated, sounds technical, sounds impossible. You know, what exists in our subconscious mind are just beliefs about who we are, usually, beliefs that are old, often coming from childhood, that lead us to see the world with a certain, let's call it a pair of glasses, with a prescription, which is often distorting how things really are. And when we can work on ourselves in a deep way and maybe do an upgrade to some of those beliefs and replace them with better beliefs, suddenly that prescription becomes a bit more clear. And so we can actually see things in a more realistic way. And that helps us show up better as people and accomplish the things we want to accomplish. So it's really about how to tackle things at a deeper level, you know, because we all have the experience of working with our conscious mind, you know, like saying, oh, I'm going to lose 10 pounds and I'm going to not snap at my kids and I'm going to, you know, be a better daughter, or, you know, whatever things we tend to have resolutions about or affirmations about or goals about. And we all have the experience of not being able to deliver on those things, you know, which is disappointing. And then, you know, we say, why? You know, we're good people. We really do want to do those things. It's not like we're not serious about it. What happens? And often what happens is that we get derailed because our subconscious mind has, let's say, beliefs that don't support what our conscious mind wants to do. So it's kind of like having one foot on the gas with the conscious mind and one foot on the brake with the subconscious mind, and then we go nowhere fast, right? So, you know, the idea would be to line up the subconscious beliefs with what we want to accomplish in our conscious mind, and then we have both feet on the gas, and then we move, you know? And I think that that's really, in a nutshell, if you will, what the book is about, how to do that.
It makes perfect sense. And your book describes the eight thinking traps. I resonated with lots of them, particularly the gifts, how you sometimes keep getting the same message until you learn from it. Can you talk through some of the thinking traps?
Yeah. So, you know, what are thinking traps? It's my little, you know, term to describe what I think are eight fundamental issues that humans grapple with. You know, how did I come to that? You know, working with people all these years in an intimate clinical setting where people open up and they're describing their issues and their problems, and I'm trying to help them at a subconscious level to, you know, go inside, understand what's happening there, and then do a software upgrade, if you will, on some of these negative beliefs that we carry, simply replace them with better beliefs. I came to see, you know, that, you know, everyone's problems on the outside look different. You know, your problems and my problems, I'm sure, are different. But when you dig down a bit deeper, we find that they're often rooted in very similar things, you know, which made me really understand that we are all really dealing with the same stuff. You know, and most of us have a lot of shame and a lot of, you know, insecurity about our deepest problems. But, you know, when you come to speak to a lot of people about those kinds of things, you realize we're all dealing with the same stuff. You know, it feels like our own private misery and our own private shame, but it's not. And if we could air those things out on a deep level more frequently without the shame, we come to realize that, you know, I'm not alone in what I'm wrestling with. Doesn't have to be any shame there, right? We're all, as humans, trying to make it better, and we're all stuck in the same kinds of things. And when I tried to distill down what are those things, I actually came up with eight things that I think cover most of it. So I'll just name them for you now. I call them thinking traps. They're little problems that we get into in the mind that keep us really stuck because we don't actually know how to get out of that thing. And that's the solution that I offer in the book. So first of all, it's understanding these eight traps. You know, we're not all going to resonate with all of them, and we're not all going to resonate equally with them. But I think that, you know, the way the book is written, it's called emotional repatterning, right? So we are trying to repattern our emotional world. And the way the book is written is that each chapter in the first eight chapters deals with a thinking trap. So we really explore each thinking trap. And I do that by telling my own patients' stories, and often my own story, for it to be very relatable to the reader. You know, so like you said, you found it to be an easy read, and it's because it's not very technical. It's more about, oh my God, I'm just like that person, or I so see myself with that person, or, oh, I would have done the exact same thing as that person. You know, so when you can relate to somebody else with a similar issue, it makes it, you know, easy for you to say, oh, wow, that's me. You know, now what do I need to do to make that better? So I think the book is written in a certain way that makes it easy to see yourself and relate to the book and say, yeah, that's something that I'm wrestling with, and here's how to fix it. So the eight thinking traps are, number one, self-love. And, you know, we can get into any of these in more detail if you're interested in any particular ones of them, but I'll just list them for now. So self-love, or, you know, a lack thereof, which is often the case, unfortunately. Second is acceptance, you know, accepting people and situations as they are, not arguing with life, as I like to put it. Responsibility, which is basically, instead of blaming everyone else on the outside for all the ways that we're suffering, is taking as much responsibility as we can for those things, which is not self-blame, but it's just saying, okay, this is my piece in it. Now that I see that, what do I need to do to make things better? The fourth one is stories, which is, you know, basically the interpretations that we make up in our conscious mind about what's happening. So the stories we tell ourselves about the events. Co-creation, which is an understanding that we're not here alone. We are in co-creation with the universe for our betterment, for our own evolution. Gifts, which seem to talk to you a lot, right? Which is, you know, understanding that we are here on planet Earth to learn and grow and evolve. That's why we are here. And so how are we going to learn and evolve? It's not by having things go great 24/7, at least in my experience. So, you know, we usually learn through challenge and difficulty, because that's when we have to dig deep and find a new coping strategy. And that helps us evolve. So, yes, we're going to have various opportunities, as we could say, to grow. And those I'm choosing to call gifts.
I like that. The positive reframing. Definitely.
Exactly. You know, we can try to re-gift certain things, but, you know, the universe will come knocking on our door again if we choose not to take the invitation the first time. Then, you know, number seven is regret, because I think a lot of people get into self-torture mode, regretting what they didn't do, what they did do, what they should have done, and all of that stuff, right? So we talk about how to deal with that. Yeah. And the last one is the subject of death, which, you know, so many people in our culture are uncomfortable with death because, you know, it's such a taboo subject, which honestly, between you and me, this is the most ridiculous thing. It's the only thing that's guaranteed here on in life. It is the only sure thing in life for sure. And yet it's so taboo and it's such a non-discussed item that everyone is uncomfortable with the subject, and that causes a lot of anxiety for people. And, you know, I try in a chapter to kind of neutralize that and normalize that, but, you know, it's working against a whole society of input. So, you know, it's a chapter.
They're all amazingly wise. I mean, it's how to have almost a happy life, but if you can take each of those lessons, and I think they're all so important. And I'd like to, I mean, I guess I'd like to chat through all of them in detail, but conscious of time. So what, I mean, is there ones that you find are more common? Like perhaps we can explore what you see more regularly, you know, in detail.
Yeah. So, you know, I think I put them in the, maybe you could say, order of importance. I hate to say it exactly that way, but let's say with the point being that self-love, which is the first one, you know, I think is really, really important. And, you know, in my work, in my clinical practice, you know, it's sad. I'm no longer shocked by it, but it is sad how many people don't love themselves at the base, you know, and often people say, oh, of course I love myself. I mean, I get a massage once a month and I, you know, do all these good things for myself. And of course I love myself. And that's, you know, the conscious mind speaking, right? Because they've done a lot of research on the brain in the last 20 years or so, understanding neuroplasticity and the ability of the brain to grow and change. And in all that research, they've come to understand that the conscious mind is only aware of about 5% of what's happening in the brain, and the rest is subconscious, so 95%. So when we understand that, we realize that the work we're doing on ourselves in the conscious mind, or what we think about ourselves in the conscious mind, is really a very small piece of the pie. So when people tell me, well, of course I love myself, you know, that means nothing to me, because this is their 5% speaking. Really, it's really what they believe deeply about themselves in terms of self-love. And when we start to do this work, I've come to see that most people, or many people anyway, don't love themselves. And You know, why is that? Well, this often comes from childhood, right? Not necessarily that we grew up with mean parents who hit us, although that could certainly be the case. But it's just because when you're 5 years old and your father yells at you, or your parents are having an argument, or someone says to you, well, you didn't do a good job there. You know, 5 year olds don't really have the context to understand, oh, my father's having a bad day, or my mother should have worded it better, or my teacher in school shouldn't have said that. You know, we, when we're five, we assume those big people know what they're doing and saying. Mm-hmm. And so if there's issues, we tend to imagine that they're with us, not with them.
Yeah.
And so often people come away from their childhood with an understanding that they're the problem, or that there is a lack of, you know, that they are not good enough and that they don't love themselves. And, you know, those subconscious beliefs don't just automatically change themselves once we hit 20 or something, right? It's like, yeah, we carry that stuff, you know, 20, 30, 50 years later. And yes, it's like old baggage that nobody really knows how to get into the subconscious and try to clean up. And that's kind of the work that I do often in my office. And that's what the book tries to, you know, have as a take home, you know, a tool. Because if we can clean up some of these deep beliefs, things are going to look a lot better. You know, if we're not well within ourselves, how well are we going to show up in any relationship, or for anybody else? You know, not very well.
Completely. So how did you, with self-love, it is, you know, I agree. I think it's a lot of things that deep down people don't have. They neglect themselves. They do superficial things to say, oh, I love myself, I go through massages. But right, deep down that there is a neglect. How did you sort of uncover this? Was it through sort of your years of clinical experience?
Well, often it is, you know, working with people. And then, you know, I'll tell you in some of the ways that a lack of deep self-love can show up. And I think when I say some of these things, you know, maybe you'll resonate with a couple of them. I certainly did. And maybe your listeners will as well. You know, one of the ways that I often find lack of self-love showing up is people with very poor boundaries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why is that? Let's dial it back. If I don't love myself, that is a very painful experience, right? So I'm carrying around this big empty hole inside myself where I don't love myself, where my own self-love should be. And because I don't necessarily realize that it's that the lack is my own self-love, I just have this big, empty, painful space there. I desperately need to get that filled. I desperately need to feel better. So what am I going to do? I'm going to look to the outside, to the people in my life, to fill that for me, because I need to feel love. So I'm going to try to get people to love me. Now, how am I going to do that? Well, I'm just going to be the nicest, best, kindest, most helpful person. You need help moving on a Saturday? Absolutely no problem. I will be there. You need me to take your kids for the weekend because you need to get away with your husband? No problem. When are you going to drop them off? You need me to run errands for you? I was just on my way out the door. I'll detour and stop at your shop. You know, I'm going to do anything for you. Why is that? It's not necessarily because I'm such a great, nice person, because the bells go off in my head when I hear this about people. It's because I want you to love me back. I want you to appreciate me. I want you to think, wow, Lisa's great. You know, she's always there for me. And, you know, she's so great and I love her. And then this is going to be my attempt to get people to love me, to fill that hole. You're smiling. So I
Do you know what? I used to be a lot like that. You know, I think we all are to some extent. And it's hard to actually start focusing on what you want as well, because I think as a society, we're told that selfish, you know.
Right. Well, this is absolutely, that's a pet peeve of mine, right? If we put ourselves first, then we're selfish, right? And this is, I don't know, a religious teaching or where this comes from. This for me is like crap. You know, you need to put yourself first in order to take good care of yourself, in order to be the best person you can be and be well inside. And from that full place, then you can show up for everybody else. But when you're coming to show up for everybody else from an empty place, that doesn't work, right? Because we can understand from the example I just gave that if I'm giving to everybody else because I actually need to get love back, first of all, that's not really a genuine place to come from, right? It's a little bit of a manipulation, even though we don't understand that consciously, right? I'm giving because I need you to give me something back, because I need to, you know, help to heal my boo-boo. The sad thing about that approach is First of all, we often don't get back what we need or the equivalent of what we gave. So that just leads to resentment and bitterness. So then we don't feel any better, we actually feel worse, right? The second point there is, if we don't love ourselves, even if we were able to get all this love back, which 90% of the time is not the case, but let's say, the sad reality is I'm not able to accept your love if I don't love myself, right? Because if I don't love me, how can I accept your love of me? I cannot. It's like the faucet is turned off. So even if you were to give me all that love, which would not often be the case, but let's say I can't accept it. So then, of course, I'm bitter and resentful because I don't even feel good. I can't receive your gift, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a lose-lose strategy. So when I hear about these super nice people who are giving everything and doing everything for everybody, I don't think that they're nice. I think, problem. Mm-hmm. Okay, the second aspect of how a lack of self-love can show up, and I certainly want to hear your thoughts on that, is perfectionism. Right, which a lot of other people are going to relate to, right? And why is perfectionism a problem? Because first of all, it should never be the goal. We are not perfect. We should not try to be perfect. It's never going to happen. It'll only lead to burnout, disappointment, and another kind of resentment, right? Why do I need to be perfect as an evidence that I don't love myself? If I don't love myself, I need to convince myself and everybody else that I'm worthy of loving. So I'm going to show up and be perfect so that if I am perfect, I can say to myself, you see how good you are. You see, you did it. You got 100%. Now can you love yourself? Now can you like yourself? Now can you feel that you're worthy? Or everybody else is going to say, wow, you're perfect. You're amazing. Your boss is going to say you get everything right all the time. That's fantastic. In school, your teacher is going to say, wow, you got a 99.5%. You're amazing. And then, you know, can then you feel like, wow, you see, I'm worthy of other people's love because I'm perfect. It's another trap.
Yeah, it's such, you know, it's such wisdom. And I relate to the old Lisa and how I used to be. But I think actually, you know, if everyone had self-love, how much better would the world be? If everyone loved themselves, it would be amazing, wouldn't it? No bitterness, resentment, this overachieving perfectionism, which is unsustainable.
Right. And me giving from a good place, not a place of need, right? Yeah. Because if I love myself and I'm well within myself, right, which I'm proposing to you that is possible and achievable. Honestly, I see this in my office after 2 or 3 sessions. We're not talking about 10 years of therapy and digging up all this stuff, my mother and my father and my this and my that. I did all that too, right? Mm-hmm. But it's like really simply going in and changing your beliefs and substituting this idea or this belief that I do not love myself or I'm not worthy of love simply for a new belief, which is I do love myself, right? It's actually that easy. When I change some of those deep beliefs and I know who I am and I know my value and worth and I know that I love myself and I'm full within myself, my gosh, I mean, I can show up so much better for the people in my life because I'm coming from such a solid foundation that the love and the showing up that I give is the real thing. It's not trying to, you know, manipulate something or get something in return so that I can feel better about myself. We can only imagine what this planet would look like. And there's a big upside here, right? Yeah. If, you know, people were in better shape within themselves. I always like to say the problem is never out there. The problem is always in here. And when we can assume responsibility for that, and I can work on myself to improve whatever I'm dealing with. Wow, it's so amazing how things change on the outside.
Completely. And, you know, it's funny, actually, I was talking to my sister about this. And we were saying, even at school, like when we were little, people used to go, oh, love yourself. You know, like it's a bad thing to love yourself. It's so like, we've just got it all wrong in so many ways.
We have it all wrong. So it's heartbreaking, actually. It's like, that's why I wrote the book. You asked me that question at the beginning, because it's like, these are so basic and fundamental. This is why I kind of came to this point. Like, how come nobody ever told us this? This is not like rocket science. These are foundational, fundamental things that should be part of being human. And just like, you know, on day one, your parents should have, you know, told you about these things. And it's like, how come my parents didn't tell me? Well, they didn't know. How come my teachers didn't, you know, say this, teach a class in this? They didn't know. I mean, this is shocking, you know? It's like, how does nobody know this? It's so basic.
Completely. And you know, actually that's a question I've got later on. I'm going to ask you now as it's relevant time. You know, I actually thought, what a shame that children aren't taught this emotional wisdom. You know,
Yes.
like, and I guess parents are so busy sorting out their own stuff because we haven't been
Yes.
taught it. By the time we realize it, our kids are like already, you know, not too late, but they're already sort of into the system. So do
Right.
you have advice for parents, you know, or plans for a book for children, you know, how to on this line, because it is such important basic stuff, you know, when you say it like that, self-love and all these other basic
Right.
traps, we should everyone
Well,
should know about it.
100%, you know, I think you can't teach what you don't know, you know, which is why we weren't raised like that. So if you're asking me, you know, how could parents use some of this for their own kids? You know, it once again comes back to ourselves. Work on you. When you are well within yourself on all these fundamental points, it's going to emanate from you automatically in how you raise your kids and what you say to your kids and how you say it to your kids. And when your kids have a problem at school or when your kids are suffering with, you know, whatever people suffer with, you know, your own wisdom, because you are rock solid, is going to, you know, communicate these values and these beliefs so that your children automatically get them. It's not like sitting down at the dinner table and saying, okay, you know, tonight we're going to work on self-love and here's how you all need to do it, you know, and then you, of course, don't love yourself. And so you're not showing up that way. So you're not, the walk and the talk don't match, right? So, you know, work on yourself. And this is what the thing is, it always comes back to us. It's never about anybody else, it's always about us. And when we're well inside, it all goes better on the outside, whether it's with your kid, with your partner, with your boss, with your friend, with whoever.
Yeah, no, completely. And you touched upon it slightly, but you know, I'd like to explore in a bit more detail. What I really like about this is that it's not going into why did it happen or how did it happen or who did it, you know, which like
Yeah.
traditional counseling can take years of working through all this. And sometimes I think, does it really matter? Like it has happened, let's move on. Can you explain a bit more detail how it does differ from that sort of traditional sort of more talk therapy?
Yeah, well, you know, many people who come to see me have been in therapy and, you know, they have a good understanding of why they got into the mess they're in. I think that they have often felt that not a lot changed as a result of the understanding. You know, the understanding for the intellectually curious is always fascinating. Okay, my father was like that, and that's why I am like this, and blah, blah, blah. It's very interesting. But I think, you know, we're at a point in our lives, or maybe, you know, I'm at a point in my life where, you know, the understanding is just not interesting anymore. I want to show up better. You know, I want to be better. I want to manage my life and my relationships better. And that understanding doesn't necessarily help me do it. And so, you know, going back into, you know, the past and dredging up all the stories and the whys and the whos and the wheres. Okay, you know, is it really so relevant? I mean, I really resonate with the way you put it. It's like, here we are now. Yes, the past happened, but it's gone. So why go there? You know, it's not necessary. We can just say, you know, I have today and I have the rest of my life forward, whether that's a month or 50 years, I don't know. But I want to be forward-looking and I want to make changes in myself today and I want to show up with those changes and be a better person every day from now on. And you know, we can spend a few minutes talking about who and why and what just to get a little perspective there, but it's not about that. It's about how do I do an upgrade, like a software upgrade on myself now so that I can enjoy the benefits of feeling better and less stuck and less misery and less suffering today.
One example that you use is an acceptance of a lady whose mother died. And actually, I think that'd be a really good example because some people might be saying, well, how do you, when something tragic has happened, how do you accept it? How do
Right.
you move on? You know, maybe you could explain
Yeah.
that in a little
So
more.
that's actually the second thinking trap, which is acceptance, which, you know, frankly, I think for me personally, I've had the hardest time with this one of all of them. You know, I always like to think, or did before I did a lot of this work, you know, he shouldn't be that way. She shouldn't have said that. This shouldn't have happened. That wasn't right. You know, and all of those kind of arguments in my head, which is the opposite of accepting, you know, kept me very stuck and distracted by all the injustice and the wrongs and the shouldn't and shouldn't have and all of that stuff. And you know, that keeps you stuck when you're in a dialogue like that, right? So finally the nickel dropped and I thought, you know what? I need to start arguing with life.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when I argue with life, I lose every single time. I have never once won. So, you know, how many years do I have to keep doing the same thing before I get, you know, he's like that, she's like that, this is like this, and this is how it is. This is how they are. This is how he is. This is how it is. Okay, I don't have to like it. Liking it is not acceptance. You know, people often, you know, confuse those things and say, well, how can I accept it? I don't like that. And, yeah, okay, you cannot like that, but you have to accept it, right? So those are different things.
So I have wise, and they all muddle those points so much, yes, don't they? It's such profound but small difference which changes your mindset on that.
Totally. I mean, I have to accept this person is this way. I may not like that person.
Mm.
I may not like the way that person is, but I have to accept that he is this way. He is not changing anytime soon. He's this way. That's him. I don't need to like it. I can't. I might like it. I don't have to like it. That's my prerogative to not like it. But I must accept it, because if I don't accept it, I spend all this time arguing in my head about how he should be different. And where's that getting anybody? It's getting anybody, nobody anywhere. That's my experience. So accept, accept, accept. I don't have to like, and I can work on changing me. I can work on changing how I relate to the situation, but I can't, I have to let go of thinking I'm going to change anyone or anything, because that's a trap. And the longer I'm in that trap, the more miserable I stay. I have to accept things. And then I have to make decisions for myself about what I want to do. If I don't like my boss and I don't like my job, it's not changing. At least I have to start there. And then I have decisions to make. Do I want to leave or do I want to stay and find a way to cope better? But I have to stop mental arguing about how things should be different. And the example you reference, which I think is a great one, is that I had a patient a few years ago who came to me, and I had been treating her with homeopathy for many years, but I hadn't seen her in a few years. And she came to me and she said, you know, my mother died a couple of years ago and I've been depressed ever since. And I'm, you know, so unhappy and so miserable. You know, my mother went in for this very simple surgery. It was a very easy procedure, in and out, nothing, you know, they wheeled her away. Bye, mom, see you in a few hours. And the unexpected happened. Somehow she died on the table. There was an error, or she had some kind of an allergy to the anesthesia. In any case, she died. And she was, you know, relatively young, and nobody was prepared for this because it was a very small procedure and there was never a discussion that it might not go well. So when my patient was informed that her mother had died, she was obviously in complete and utter shock. And fast forward 3 years, she came to my office and she said, you know, my mother died and I'm so miserable and depressed and I can't take it. And I said, what about her death is the hardest thing for you? And she said, well, it shouldn't have happened. You know, this, my mother was only 48 and this was a simple procedure and it should have been in and out and a 3-day recovery and it wasn't her time and she shouldn't have died. And I'm so upset that she died.
Mm.
And so I said, well, you know, I'm very direct. I can't help that. Hopefully I'm kind and compassionate, but I'm very direct because I don't know how else to be. And I said to her, well, of course she should have died. And the patient looked at me and she's like, well, how could you say that? And I said, well, she should have died because she did die.
Mm.
I mean, we have to stop fighting with life. She did die, so she should have died because that's what happened. I mean, you know, life doesn't make mistakes. This is what happened, and so it should have happened. How do we know? Because it did happen. You don't have to like that it happened. I completely agree. It's horrible that it happened. Mm. It's terrible that it happened. But you can't say it shouldn't have happened, because that's, you will never get out of that if you keep arguing with what happened.
Yeah.
Because, you know, 3 years later, she didn't even get to grief. She was still with the argument that it shouldn't have happened. So of course she was depressed. She never had a chance to grieve her mother. I said, did you cry about your mom? She said, not once.
Yeah.
She's still in an argument. She's still angry with life. And you're never going to get out of that. So step one was, your mother had to die. It was her time to go. Who are you to say it shouldn't have happened? It was her time. That's it. Yes, you're unhappy. Yes, you're in grief. Yes, you miss your mom. I totally agree with the rest of it. Now let's go there. Now how do we process the grief? Now how do we move through your mother's death and move to a place where you can feel like some level of peace inside, right? But Arguing with life is a bad strategy. We will always lose.
Yeah. And I can feel that then, you just saying that, like, while she's not accepting it, it's like a tight wound up ball. And then as soon as you say it happened, you know, it should have happened. You can feel, oh, I can feel almost the grief coming out. It's just, you can then release it and move on. Right. But if you're stuck in that verbal, you know, internal argument, how are you ever going to get to be peaceful again?
Right. And you know, fast forward, you know, we did three sessions together. In fact, I just saw her yesterday. So it's funny we're talking about her. Yeah. But, you know, she's much, much better. I mean, in every way. She said, my whole life has changed. I'm a completely different person. You know, she misses her mom. 100% she misses her mom. Yeah. But it has a lightness to it. You know, she knows her mom's on the other side and she knows her mom is there. And yeah, she misses her mom. And she's sad that her mom left when she did. But she's no longer in this internal argument that made her so miserable. She's just now stepped into the truth. You know, we all are going to die here. And we're not in control of the timing. And that makes people anxious, right? Because it's like an unknown. And we all like to think we control everything. And that's complete BS.
Yeah.
As we have figured out in the last year and a half, if we didn't know before.
I think everyone's figured that out to some extent. But maybe some earth healing for the greater humanity will come out the last year and a half.
Yes, I see it that way too.
So how do you actually use emotional repatterning to get rid of these thinking traps? You know, how do you do it in your practice?
Right. So what we do is I have a technique that I use with people called applied kinesiology or muscle testing. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. It's
I've seen a kinesiologist. It's like it's something I want to learn. It's like witchcraft.
Right. It is a little bit out there. I know it is a little bit out there. I mean, you know, it's described in detail in the book, and it's basically it's, I like to use the analogy of it's a bit like a lie detector test, right? Mm. You know, so, and it's kind of a little mini lie detector test that you can use on yourself to find out what's true for you and to find out what's not true. And so when you use that little technique, you find out what's true, meaning what you believe, and you find out what's not true, which is meaning what you don't believe. And so we can, you know, try to kind of dig down our problems to the roots. You know, I like to say that I like to work on the roots of the problem, not the leaves, right? Because there are thousands and thousands of leaves and there are, you know, fewer roots. So when we boil it down and we try to look for what the roots are, and we can change those roots and upgrade the beliefs there, then of course the leaves get healthier, right? So that happens automatically. So all those external situations in our lives, you know, which we're so consumed with, will automatically improve when we don't necessarily deal with the ins and outs and the details of each situation, but when we kind of get to what's happening on a deeper level that's responsible for why these situations are upsetting to us, right? That makes some sense.
Yeah. No, I love kinesiology. It is absolutely fascinating. I might have to get you on just to do a whole session on that.
Exactly.
I just absolutely love it.
After we do some of the applied kinesiology or muscle testing to discover what we deeply believe and what we then don't believe, right? Because it's what we don't believe, that's the piece that we want to change. So if I don't believe I love myself, of course, I want to now insert in place of it a belief that I do love myself, right? So the second piece of that is actually changing the beliefs. And that's what I go into in great detail in the book, because it's one thing to understand all the parts that don't work, right? It's another thing to then make the change. So the muscle testing part is just to really confirm what's happening in our subconscious mind, but that doesn't really change anything. It just validates what we suspect might be true. The real gem, I think, in the book and what's really to be called emotional repatterning is to actually change the beliefs. And I give a step-by-step process in the book of how to change at the subconscious level these negative beliefs that we carry. And it basically is a matter of reteaching ourselves a new belief, relearning. And how do we do that? It's much deeper than like a mantra or, you know, affirmations, you know, looking in the mirror and saying 10 times, I love myself. That's not going to do much, because then we're dealing with the conscious mind, right? We want to change these beliefs at the subconscious level. And so the question is how to do that. And there is a technique that was developed in the 80s, actually, by a gentleman named Paul Dennison, which was called Brain Gym. I don't know if you've ever heard of Brain Gym, but this man with kids who had learning disabilities. And he discovered through his work with kids that there's a way to engage the brain for easier and deep learning. And when we can engage the brain to learn something on a very deep level, that these kids who had these disabilities for learning were able to learn much better, much faster, and much deeper. And so many people have used, you know, some of the techniques that he developed to develop their own different approaches to emotional repatterning, or, you know, dealing on a deep level with subconscious beliefs. And so essentially what it is, and I go into the detail of how to do it in the book, it's engaging both the right and left hemispheres of the brain at the same time. When we can engage both hemispheres of the brain at the same time, then the brain is in a state of openness and an ability to learn something in a very deep way. And so I teach how to do this, how to engage the brain on a holistic level. And then when we do the technique of teaching ourselves a new belief, it goes into the deep subconscious mind and we really learn it on a deep level. And then, of course, we can go back to the end and use this muscle testing technique to check to see that if, in fact, the new belief is now true for us, if we really do believe it. So, you know, the muscle testing piece is more the verification part of it. What do we actually believe now? And were we successful at changing it? But the real gem, I think, is learning this tool of how to engage the brain in such a way that we can replace an old negative belief with a positive belief that we would prefer to have instead, like a software upgrade. And, you know, this is what I think is really the interesting piece of it, and what I think the book offers, not just, oh my gosh, we have all these thinking traps, we have all these problems, which, you know, I think we can relate to a lot of them, but then really how to make the change in a deep and effective and simple way. You know, a lot of people say, well, that was it. You know, that's it. You know, I've had this bad belief for 40 or 50 years. And, you know, within 4 minutes, I'm going to change it. And, you know, it's funny because maybe you've also seen the same thing. Some of the most profound things in life are kind of the simplest things, right? You know, we tend to overcomplicate things often. You know, it doesn't have to be hard in order to work or to be effective, right? And this technique is actually pretty straightforward.
And is it something that people can adapt to use on themselves, do you think, as will it still be effective to some extent?
Yes, because, you know, not everybody has a practitioner. And although I do work, you know, at a distance with people, you know, sometimes people want to just give it a try themselves. And so I've written it in such a way, and you've read the book, so, you know, you can weigh in on whether or not you think it would be possible. But I've tried to really boil it down in the most simple terms to how to actually do this by yourself at home. It's not hard. It's really a matter of taking a few minutes and, you know, just doing the exercise and, you know, rewiring your brain. It's doable.
You have given step-by-step instructions. I actually need to do that bit. See, I've read the book, but actually people need to make sure that they do the key thing.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that's the critical part, isn't it?
People because, you know, it's more than an intellectual exercise, because when you're reading, you know, about the thinking traps, you're still dealing with your conscious mind, right?
Yeah, completely.
And that's your conscious mind saying, oh yeah, that's me, or oh, I could relate to that, right? But the change isn't going to come from understanding that. That's just a step, right? The change is going to come really by rewiring these patterns that we have in our subconscious that keep us so locked in. And it's not hard. It's so easy. It's so doable. And I've had patients come back, and people who've read the book come back and say, you know, I actually sat down for half an hour with myself. I wrote a list of belief statements that I would rather believe instead. And I used the technique one by one. I went through the statements and it was easy. And, you know, people can feel like a huge shift after just one session like that. You know, it's, I like to say the prescription in your glasses gets so much better. You know, you just feel so well within yourself, and just suddenly everything on the outside starts to shift because you're not the same, right? And so instead of focusing on all the others and fixing all the other people so that they, you know, show up better for us, you know, it's just so much more powerful when we can take matters into our own hands, work on ourselves, and then we show up better on the outside and things shift.
Definitely, completely. And it would be great as well if other people, other practitioners do offer this service of yours and
Yes.
for people that perhaps want to sit, do it with a practitioner. It's just amazing. There's so much opportunity there for improvement for
Right, and
everyone.
I think that this is a field that's growing. You know, it's called energy psychology. You know, you might have heard of tapping or emotional freedom
Yes.
technique. You're right, so that's under the same umbrella. It's not exactly the same as what we're talking about today, but I mean, it is related in the sense that these are take-home tools that people can learn, they can do themselves to relieve, you know, anxiety and stress and difficulty and all these things. They're very accessible, and I think that people are really benefiting from this new evolution of the field of psychology in the last years.
It's exciting. Well, the world needs change right now, I think. So this is
That's true.
a great tool to be giving
Yeah, and
everyone.
change starts with each one of us, right? I mean, we know that, but it's actually really true. If each of us do our part of the work, wow, can we imagine how great life really could be here on this planet?
Do you use emotional repatterning sort of as a session on its own, or do you use it alongside your other therapies? How do you actually apply it when you see a
Right.
patient?
So yeah, that's a good question because, you know, I've been in practice for over 20 something years. And, you know, for the bulk of that, the early part of that, I was primarily doing homeopathy and naturopathy. And, you know, naturopathy in terms of diet and lifestyle things, and homeopathy, as you well know, is, you know, a holistic approach to, you know, helping the whole person. And, you know, most of the time when you give a great homeopathic remedy, it helps the person physically, mentally, emotionally, and you get all this great, you know, whole person response. But I came to notice over the years that sometimes, despite having given a great remedy to somebody and they were really better on a lot of points, they were still emotionally stuck, you know, either anxious or depressed or, you know, whatever, wound up in their head with negative thoughts. And I always wondered, gee, why doesn't the remedy that helped them in all these other ways also help that aspect too sometimes? And it was something that was puzzling me, and I still don't know the answer. Maybe the answer is that it's more like habits that we're in, right? Because, you know, homeopathy is not necessarily going to help bad habits. But I started to think, gee, I wish I had an adjunct therapy or some other tool in my tool bag that I could use to help the patients who are still so stuck emotionally, despite being on a great homeopathic remedy. And so I myself became trained in numerous different techniques starting, you know, maybe 8 years ago. And I've taken many different trainings and things. And so I kind of, you know, wove them all in together. So there was a kind of an amalgamated approach of all these things that I started using with patients directly when they were still stuck, you know, on some of the emotional things. And so now what I do is I use you know, homeopathy and naturopathic approaches with the emotional technique that I discuss in the book, Emotional Repatterning, when there is a need to do so, right? So I feel like right now they complement each other very well. If a homeopathic remedy takes care of everything, then great, you know, we're done. But if there's this other piece where someone is really stuck, then, you know, we get together for a couple of sessions of emotional repatterning, or sometimes people just make an appointment with me for the emotional repatterning work because they know they're stuck, you know, with something in themselves, which is, you know, showing up as a block in how they live their lives. So I do think it's all very complementary, you know, and it has a place on its own.
I think it must be really powerful to use them all together. You know, I know from my own personal experience when I started seeing a homeopath many years ago, you know, there could be some painful emotional releases when I took a remedy, but I was prepared for that and wanted to do it. But I do know when I see some patients, they've got traumas, or they sometimes say, "I just don't want to go there." As where I think something like this would really help
And you know,
potentially.
especially because, you know, most people don't say that they don't want to go there, but you know, I have had people not want to go there. And sometimes when it's really trauma, like let's say rape or abuse, you know, people just can't bear the thought of retelling it or, you know, reliving it in any way. And, you know, for me, that's still okay because a lot of what we do is work on, you know, core beliefs about our own selves. You know, I love myself. I have infinite worth and value. I trust myself. I believe in myself. I'm a good person. I have confidence in myself. You know, we can then, you know, get, you know, expand things out into something more relevant to the exact situation that somebody's dealing with. But, you know, I have a right to exist. I am enough. you know, I set boundaries easily. You know, these are really core things. You know, I like to think of it as, you know, all of us inside are a bit like Swiss cheese. You know, the bumps and bruises of life have taken their toll, and there's certain fractures, let's say, inside our foundation. And when we do this work on just core beliefs, not even on any one particular situation, and we fill in those holes in the Swiss cheese, or we fill in those fractures, and we become more solid in our foundation and really well within ourselves, well, then we are much more able to put the past to rest and show up in a less reactive way about things that happened in the past, you know, because we're just more well within ourselves. And I think a lot of the work is simply just doing that.
I love that. I love that analogy. I'm really conscious of your time, and I'm running over. So I just want to ask, where can people find out more, and where's your book available for people to read?
Right. Thank you. Well, the book is called Emotional Repatterning: Healing Emotional Pain by Rewiring the Brain. And it actually just shipped a few weeks ago and is doing pretty well. So that's exciting. It's on, whatever major booksellers are. Actually, the publisher is from the UK. It's John Hunt Publishing. Okay. It's O Books. So that's fun. And I have had a lot of people buying it from the UK, which is also fun. So it's an international book right now. So you can find it pretty much wherever books are sold. And, you know, I've gotten great feedback on it. People feel that it's very approachable, and the stories that I tell about patients make it, you know, very illustrating things that people can relate to. So hopefully if your readers give it a chance, that they will find that that's the case.
Definitely. And I will be recommending it to my patients, because I do think it's almost just essential life skills in there, and lessons to be learned. It's a lot of wisdom and just very simple to understand. I love it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa. It's been lovely to have you. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with the world, because I think it's a lot more, but people will gain a lot from it.
Great. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
It's been lovely to chat. Thank you.
Same here. You're very lovely. I think it's great that you had me on. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been lovely to chat. Thank you.
All right. You take care. Bye-bye. Bye.